to have longevity in a relationship, you got to know that it's going to be a roller coaster ride, and there's going to be moments where you are deeply connected with each other, and there's going to be moments where you're going to be sitting on the couch next to each other thinking in your head, this person bores the shit out of me. And there's going to be moments that you're just frustrated with each other. And then there's going to be moments where you fall in love again and again and again. But if you don't have the capacity to get through that boring stuff and the frustrating stuff, if you don't have the capacity to do that, and I don't use the words love with that part, I use the words connection. It's you are deeply connected to each other to get through the hard stuff. But in our world, you know, we always go, oh, and they lived happily ever after. Nah, the ever after is not happily. It's up and down all the time.
So are you somebody who, much like my wonderful wife, Audrey, is in a relationship with a person who has a different brain? It could be your husband, your wife, one of your siblings, a parent, could even be one of your kids, could be a friend. Jodie Rogers turned the spotlight onto the absolute humanity and longing and need for intimacy and connection that we have in all of us. But she did it by exploring what those things mean for neurodivergent people through her work on the fabulous television series Love on the Spectrum. For anybody who's trying to or has ever tried to engage with another person on an emotional or intimate level, this episode is just fantastic, regardless of where people's brains are. And if you've ever struggled with getting emotionally close to someone who is neurodivergent, and I know firsthand what that can look like when I see Audrey trying to tackle connecting with me when my brain is doing its thing, this episode is absolutely wall-to-wall with tools, with techniques, with advice, and just a heap of validation. I know this is audio, but this episode is going to make you feel seen. I mean, really, really seen. Before we get to Jodie, we've got to pay the rent. We're going to play some ads and then we're going to get into the chat.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
G'day, welcome to the show. This is Better Than Yesterday, helping you making today better than yesterday since 2013. G'day, my name is Osher Ginsberg. Thanks for being here. I am a podcaster, clearly. I'm also a best-selling author. I'm a husband. I'm a dad. I'm a stepdad. Sometimes I work in television. Sometimes I compost dog poo. I'm a farmer. I'm a worm farmer. And I'm also the proud curator of a whole slew of pet acronyms. I've got a little OCD. No, I've actually got a lot. I've got OCD, ADHD, PTSD, probably some other stuff that's yet to be diagnosed. Yet that can wait its turn while I continue to work on those three biggies. Thank you for being here. I'm glad you're here. Jodie Rogers is here. She is the sexologist, the counselor, and the special education teacher that you would have seen if you've ever watched an episode of Love on the Spectrum. I love that show. I can't wait for you to hear this conversation. Jodie has degrees on degrees on degrees. She's so crazily, crazily qualified. But when you listen to her, she's really mindful of the way she comes across. It's quite disarming that someone who has done so much work and is so knowledgeable is not, there's no barrier that is often there between someone who's done that amount of work and the person that they're speaking to through the academic language or a tone of voice or a way of talking about things. She's got this extraordinary ability to communicate quite complicated psychological concepts very, very clean and clearly. And it's quite disarming. I loved it. Jodie's got a lot of wisdom and the guidance and the space that she's holding for people just trying to get a little better at loving somebody or being loved is profound. She's magnificent. Jodie's just written a book. It's called Unique, and she's every bit as smart and as funny and as real can be, as you think she is. It's an honor. It was an honor to connect with Jodie, and I know you're absolutely going to love this one. Jodie, I'm glad you're here. Thank you for coming.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I'm glad you got here a little bit early and got a little bit of Audrey time.
Yes, what a delightful human.
She is. She's an extraordinary person.
Yeah.
Incredibly kind and did a lot of heavy lifting in me being able to be where I am today.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say if it was an unfair burden, she, you know, chose to be, a, you know, she chose not to and she chose to. There's some points where I was like, she's like, I can't, got a capacity, but I'm enormously lucky to have someone like that in my life.
Yeah.
Who I was real honest with her and Georgia about what was going on with me when I first met them. I was on antipsychotics and I was like really big.
Yeah.
I'm really lucky to have both of them. Lucky you got her. Georgia's like, whew, she's like the wind. She's 20. She's like, you hear a car come and go and there's some gym clothes on the floor and then you smell like that's her cologne. I think she was here.
Yeah, it's like a ghost that comes and goes, isn't it?
You know what it's like.
Though, yeah, right? Definitely, yeah, definitely.
It is, and you know, she's never impressed by anything I do, as kids aren't.
No,
but she loves the show. So I sent her a screenshot this morning of an article I was reading. For Get Ready for This. It's like, just so you know, Jodie's coming today. Yeah.
It's amazing actually how many young people do really love the show. But really love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been very, very fortunate.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's, I mean, I know what I get out of it, but why do you think people find such a delight in watching it?
There's a couple of things. I think Love on the Spectrum came out at a really incredible time because if you think about it, at first the series when it first came on the ABC was at the end of 2019 and then was picked up by Netflix in 2020, and we always know what that was, a year of all of us being highly distressed.
Yeah.
So I think it was perfect timing.
And at home.
At home, stuck at home. And it's a show that's really joyful. Mm. So I think that that's the first thing. It actually is a show that people watch and get a lot of joy out of. But the thing that I find really interesting, this is a show about autistic people and about autistic people's way of moving through the world. But I can't tell you how many times I'll show people would say, but that's what I do, or that's what I experience, or that's exactly like me. So it was just highly relatable, I think, particularly for anybody of that age when we're talking about, you know, people who are sort of starting to get on the dating scene, going into relationships, thinking about relationships with other people. I just think everybody related to it. And I love that because all of a sudden, particularly neurotypical people are talking about highly relatable moments with people that they may have never in their day-to-day life. They might say, I've never met an autistic person. They probably have.
Yeah.
But, I just think it was really relatable. What do you think?
What do I love about it? There's something about the cast. And I worked in reality television a very long time.
Yeah.
There's something about the casting which at its core is just completely wholesome.
Mm.
And it is each person, I'm sure each person has the, I'm sure there's shitty bits out of everybody, you know.
Yeah.
There's a reason, I've got wet shorts. There's a reason I was sprayed with a hose this morning, all right? But the way that each character is introduced, you are just so enrolled in them finding a happiness that neurotypical people take for granted.
Yeah.
And it never, I mean, if you don't think about it, you can, you know, and it's difficult to, you know, accept that, oh, no, that sort of thing, those people don't get to have this, or those people don't need, actually, no, everybody needs the feeling of a naked body pressed against them. It is a thing, does something in your head that makes everything better.
Yeah.
And it is something we desire, and it's good for us, and it makes our brains work properly, and those releases of hormones and are a part of us, and the adjustments of our behavior and the things we prioritize are ultimately very healthy when we start to want that feeling and we start to pull things out of our lives that otherwise might not be good for us. And that's a really important part of life.
So important.
And we're built for it.
Yeah. Do you know, you're singing my tune, because really interesting, my beginning career, I was a special education teacher. So working in segregated special schools in a high school that had 200 young people in there, all adolescents. So you imagine adolescence. It's just hormone city, basically. But what I was seeing was that there was such a huge focus on when people with a disability, so I'm talking cognitive disability, complex disability, when they left school, there was a huge focus on employment, which of course is so important.
Yeah, yeah.
Daily living skills, independence. But for me, I was going, but what about relationships?
Yeah.
What about sexuality? What about intimate relationships? And it was just kept... It was like an alarm that kept going, like almost like a shark alarm, kind of going, because in my lifetime, relationships, I'm not just talking about intimate romantic relationships, I'm talking about all relationships, is actually what makes the world and life the most important thing. You know, at the end of the day, I don't think anybody's going to look back and go, oh, Jodie, you know, she did this or she did that, or people are going to say she was a good friend. She was a great sister. She was, you know, that's what I want to be known, a good mum. You know, all of these things, I want to be listed as that, not kind of the things we tick off to our company, which are important, of course, for our own identity, but our relationships are essential. So you saying that understanding that people watch a show and we become very invested, it's because we're all invested.
Yeah. And it really does a lot to, and look, as much as I love James Bond, hasn't done a lot for people who are either living with a disability or people who have, a non-typical appearance. Like, look at a James Bond baddie, with the exception of Christopher Walken, they've got a limp, they've got a weird eye, they're in a wheelchair. Like, the Bond villains are always, I'm going to get you. Like, the non-typical human form is, watch out for that. It's the hunchback. It's this. I'm very close to 50, like days away from being 50. And I am purely quoting a sign I would drive past every day on the way to school in Brisbane. It was the such and such school for spastics.
Yep.
That was it. We had a demountable at the school that I went to that was on the bottom oval, and the bell went at 9:15 and the other bell went at 2:30. So they arrived after we got there and they left before we got out.
Yeah.
And every time we went to sport or whatever, we'd go down and you just hear chaos coming out of this weird little demountable, looked like a mining donga, and that's just where they stayed. Good luck.
Yep.
Off your pop.
Yep. that's my experience.
And that's your outcome.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinary that in my lifetime that's different now.
Yeah.
And I wonder, though, if there are there people who are older than me who went through that experience who didn't have the kind of work that you would or access or a community going, oh, Gavin's found a cuddle person. Like, no, it's like, fucking don't talk to me, don't look at my kids. That was what life was for them. I mean, really hard if you're like 50, 60 watching this show now going, where was that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and there's so many people that, as well, because, you know, when we're talking about autistic people, until the early 90s, we didn't even look at somebody having a neurological difference that didn't have an intellectual disability. So, you know, you had to be diagnosed as autistic before that time.
Yeah.
You had to have an intellectual disability.
Double winner.
Yeah, exactly. And then we kind of went, oh, hang on. So a person can actually have average IQ, brilliant IQ, in the multiple different ways that we show intelligence, but not having learning difficulty. Oh, but they can also have difficulties. It's like we always had those times we'd say you either have to be academically bright or keep up with the pace of learning, or you have to be able to tie your own shoes, wipe your own ass, basically. But we never looked at the struggles that people have in terms of you can be able to be independently able to look after yourself. You can be a really intelligent person in terms of your academic intelligence. But what about your emotional regulation? What about your capacity to interact with other people? What about your ability to be able to move through a world with our sense? You know, we didn't even talk about sensory stuff that many years ago. So you're right. I think we still got to break down a lot of misconception that still exists because they're people of my age who still they go, no, I've never met an autistic person. Oh, I don't know anybody like that. No, you do.
Yeah.
You do. You just have to
Kevin, who's really good with spreadsheets, the one in accounts, he doesn't look him in the eye much, but can recite a formula you need to get this cell from that one to that and pull a currency. Kevin. Guess what?
Yeah. Good on you, Kevin. We need a Kevin.
Because you talk about the independence, right? And there's someone close to me who works in OT and you know, I've been trying to get this guy to come work with me because he's extraordinary talent. He's like, mate, this works, makes my heart sing, man. I can't, I have to do this.
Yeah.
You know, he goes and he's a part of, you know, helping someone who's 19, 20 get from their house to the bus to the shops to get all the things on their grocery list, go through the checkouts, get back on the bus, get home, put it away and cook a meal.
Yep.
And that might seem, it might seem pedestrian to somebody listening going, well, so you've got five people working on that day to help this person do this. Mm. By the time that thing comes a routine, what does it do? That person's mum, dad, brother, other support, like the amount of, oh, it's a terrible word, burden.
Yeah.
That puts upon the people close to them. That so the connection with the people close to them, there's moments where resentment can creep in, you know, if it's a mum or a brother or a sister or a son or a daughter. Oh, fuck, I've got to go do this. If they're independent, then you get to just have an emotional connection with them or a friendship connection.
Yeah.
And that is extraordinary. It's if you are helping not just that person, you're helping everybody around them by fostering that independence and focusing on their ability to have relationships, not only is great for those moments, but, oh, mate, we all know, I'm sure the prisons are full of people who had poor relationship skills and made a choice out of fear.
Yep.
And now they're doing 10 in the pen.
Yep.
For
And education. You know. So if we're talking about relationships, part of my job is working with people that I hate these words, but I'm going to use the words. So they talk about people having sexualized harming behavior or sexualized behaviors of concern.
Yeah.
And do you know every single time I'll show that I'm working with somebody that has been incarcerated and they have an intellectual disability or they are an autistic person, and if they don't, you know, if their disability doesn't allow them within our law to say, actually, this person didn't actually understand the consequence, if they had kind of some understanding, nearly every single time it's actually about education and it's also about desperation. It's about the I so badly want to be with this person. That's one thing, without having the mechanism or ways of being able to connect with other people. And the other side, it's things where people don't, they haven't been given the education to say, if you think about it, even when we talk about consent at the moment, and we talk about, you know, it has to be affirmative consent. You've got to be able to gain consent from another person. To gain consent, you have to be able to ask. If you have difficulty with initiating conversation, how do you ask? To give consent, we have to know what is ongoing, what is affirmative, what is, enthusiastic. You have to know what all of that looks like in that way. And so I've had people that I work with that even will say, hey, do I have to stop? So they may have a partner, they may be having partnered sex, but then they have broken consensuality down into minute form. So they're saying, So say we're in missionary position, but I want to go on top. Do I have to stop and ask that? Or, you know, are we able to? Because some of us know that if we show consent through our body language, just by being able to roll our bodies, that we actually have a consensual way of understanding that for some people, but there's other people that would not know that.
Mm.
They wouldn't know whether that's consensual or not. So these are things I break some of the most incredible parts of human relationships and sexuality down into really, I know it seems like a weird job, but breaking things down into really small parts so that every single person on this planet has accessible information about stuff that you, I, you know, other people, we might take that for granted, that we might take for granted the incredible skill it takes to be able to match another person's body and be able to silently and with no verbal communication give consent to one another. That can get some people in really, really big trouble.
And it's hard, it's so hard to have this conversation because it's such a given mm-hmm. for so many people considering
yep.
it.
Yep.
And it's so completely foreign to think that, well, what do you mean you don't know?
Yeah.
Like Audrey laughs at me all the time. I have a hard time recognizing emotional responses in faces.
Yep.
All right?
Yep.
I find other cues that can give me a thing. It makes me great at my job when I'm dumping people on national television and they're bawling in front of me. All right? And it's only afterwards do I go, oh, you know, sometimes, yeah. not all the time. Sometimes I'm really there. Sometimes yeah. I'm like, I can't tell if how upset you are, but yeah. I'm guessing by the context of the situation, this is a very upset time. So I speak in my upset voice. Like, masking, I think it's called. Like I do that. It makes me great at my job when I need to, right?
Yeah.
But not everybody knows that that's somehow people go through life like that. Like I never understood.
So nobody ever talked to you about like micro expressions?
I did not know about micro. I didn't know about micro expressions until I was 29.
Really? 30.
And I had a woman I was seeing at the time show me. We were watching some, you know, before true crime, we were watching some, I don't know, someone was getting interviewed on TV. It was a perp. It was a, you know, confession in the, like it was an actual documentary. And she went, look at his face. I said, what do you mean? She goes, see how his jaw's clenching? And she had to rewind it. It was videotape or a DVD. I can't remember. She had to rewind it. I was like, oh. She's like, yeah, he's holding a lot of tension. And before that, she showed it in me. She goes, what's going on? I was like, nothing. She's like, you keep clenching your jaw. What's going on? I also didn't know what was going on in me. I was so distant from what was happening. So I have a hard time sometimes understanding that, all right? And that's to expand that. And I've just had to learn from contextual cues. I still can't get it right. I get people wrong all the time. I go, hey, how you going? And Audrey's like, it's not him. Damon Herriman, classic. We're watching some old show and I'm texting him, hey, man, I saw you on the show. He goes, I wasn't in that show. Fuck. Yeah. And so I understand that about me. But to take that to another level of like, I don't know if this person is into this or not. I can't pick up on cues. Yeah. I actually have no idea.
Yeah.
You know, I know words and that's about it. You know, I can't tell, you know, your hands crossed across your body like this or down to your sides or touching my face is all the same thing for some people.
Definitely.
Very difficult for neurotypical people to comprehend, particularly when passing judgment on what they see, observe in front of or something they read about.
Yep.
And that's a real, real challenge to be up against. Do the people that you work with, are they aware of the biases that people have about them?
Do you know, that's probably the majority of my job. So what I do often in my work is people, you know, some people, many people actually, will come to me and go, they know there's been a communication breakdown or something's happened or somebody's been upset with them or something's gone on, but they're not sure why that has happened. And so It's like I do translation often. So when, you know, I call it social autopsies. So what I'll do is say, okay, let's think about the circumstance. Let's look at what happened, explain the face, and people, I don't know, understand the face. So it's helping, it's kind of helping many people that I work with to go, this is the expectation of neurotypical people. So when you do this, they're expecting you to do it in a neurotypical way. I would never, ever ask an autistic person or a neurodiverse person to go mask, because we know masking is so bad for people's mental health. It is incredibly bad for people.
It's how I get through the day.
Well, but you also will be exhausted.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, it's exhausting. And so I'm aware of that. But people, you know, and lots of people I know mask throughout a day, but then what people won't know is that then when they get home, they are completely spent. They're burnt out by that. Or so my job often is saying, okay, well, this is what neurotypical, and a neurotypical person reacted to you in that way because they think you're going to do it in a neurotypical way. So how can we help you understand that expectation? And then how can you communicate how you're perceiving with words often? Osha, it's with words. But people, and it's hard because being able to say, I don't understand what your face is doing.
Yeah.
Or can you tell me what you're feeling? Or it takes a lot of guts to be that open with somebody else to ask them specific questions. But I'll tell you what, I reckon the planet would be far better off if we actually communicate in that way. And that's what a lifetime of hanging out with neurodiverse people has taught me. If I'm with anybody in my life, even before the miscommunications happened, if I go, I don't know what they're thinking. I don't know what they're feeling. I just ask it now. It's almost like I've taken on this thing and go, well, did you understand what I just said? Or I wasn't listening to you. Or can you say that again? Or sorry, can you say that again? Or I don't understand what your face is doing. Or, you know, I just ask it now. But that's not my neurotypical self. That's what I have learnt by hanging out with people that have taught me to be a better communicator, because they are forced. Many, many people that I work with are forced to be really great communicators because they've got to think about it. I don't think about it, but many people have to think about it.
It's extraordinary. I did not expect that the things that you would be talking about I'd find so relatable. I ask all those questions when I'm speaking with Audrey upstairs. To the point now where I don't understand your face and your words don't match.
Yeah.
But I say that to the point, and what I say it so much, I think there might be an expectation that I'm going to figure it out one day.
Yeah.
And I wish I could, so I'd get to stop asking this. But I know that sometimes it can give her a feeling, not all the time, but I know it can give her a feeling that I don't see or hear her.
Yeah.
And I don't really see who she truly is.
Yeah.
And that can cause a hurt. And I really struggle. I can guess sometimes, but when I truly don't know, particularly if I try to pay attention to what my body's doing. Mm. And if I'm like feeling like a flood or something big going on, it's like, this feels bigger than what's actually happening here.
Mm.
Let me check what's going on.
Mm.
And then I'm just, you know, like a slingshot been pulled back, and it's actually nothing that I thought it was. But then there's a feeling of like, oh, hang on, you don't get it. You don't get me. It can get out of hand.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to do.
Yeah. And you used that really amazing word before about expectation. And I think that's it. We don't communicate our expectations well enough with each other. And so particularly, you know, I have one way of thinking about the world. You have another way of thinking about the world. Definitely when you're in a long-term intimate relationship with a partner, you almost expect each other to mind read each other all the time. You are. And so, you know, why doesn't Audrey get me? Or Audrey be thinking, why doesn't Osha do it like this? Because we just move through the world with our own perspective and our own point of view. Communicating that to another person, I think, is the most complex thing. And to have, we're always told, you know, get in another person's shoes, see it from their perspective. That's actually not an easy thing to do. It's not easy. And then when you're in the relationship that you're in, a beautiful relationship with a wonderful partner, then also you're worrying about the monotony of asking the question again and again and again. But it's you need it. You know, you require it of going, but if I ask her this many times, is she thinking, oh, shit, you know, am I going to have to answer this for the rest of my life?
Pretty much. I think that's what it is. There was a guy, I can't remember which season it was, but it was a moment where one of the kids, I'm so old, I call them kids.
Yeah.
One of the kids goes, oh, because when I get a girlfriend, there'll be no more problems.
Mm.
And the next line broke my heart and everyone who was watching. It's like, oh, mate, there's still problems.
Really?
Yeah, bud.
But you figure it out.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think that that's a thing that we don't talk about enough. We don't talk about people believe, you know, I'm going to meet someone, they're going to be my soulmate. And we have this expectation. And there's an expectation.
All
yeah.
Right.
Oh, my God, I've met the love of my life. I've met my soulmate.
Join Instagram account on holiday forever. Off we go.
I always say that we should be re-talking about this, and we should be talking about the fact that relationships, to have longevity in a relationship, you got to know that it's going to be a roller coaster ride, and there's going to be moments where you are deeply connected with each other. And there's going to be moments where you're going to be sitting on the couch next to each other thinking in your head, this person bores the shit out of me. And there's going to be moments that you're just frustrated with each other. And then there's going to be moments where you fall in love again and again and again. But if you don't have the capacity to get through that boring stuff and the frustrating stuff, if you don't have the capacity to do that, and I don't use the words love with that part. I use the words connection. It's you are deeply connected to each other to get through the hard stuff. But in our world, you know, we always go, oh, and they lived happily ever after. Nah, the ever after is not happily. It's up and down all the time.
It's not like, you know, think about it with kids. Every parent knows. There's no kid that is an absolute angel.
No.
It comes with everything.
We're humans.
And then last night, you know, Audrey, she goes in Wolfie's room to turn the fan off or something. It was like 10 o'clock. She goes, look at that. And there he is. We've figured out, I'll tell you this, sister.
Yeah.
We've figured out that Wolfgang, he's 4 and a bit.
Yeah.
He has an allergy to bees.
Oh.
Bath, brushing, bed, the bike, breakfast. Anything that involves the letter B.
Oh, that's funny.
He's like, oh, can we just go downstairs into the tool shed? Because I need to find no, we're eating breakfast right now. Yeah, but Dad, I really need to get the staple gun because no, you don't. And yeah, so that was one of the days yesterday. Like,
yeah.
It's not bedtime. It's like, but what about no bed? And so it was real pork chop, proper pork chop. And at 10 o'clock last night, she opens the door and there he is with Bunny asleep. She's like, oh. But that's what it is when you are with a partner as well. There's all those things that shit you to tears and you cannot expect to have the moments of, oh, without them.
Yeah.
That is what the deal is.
Yeah. But
we're just not. We don't have a realistic expectation of what a relationship actually looks like. There's healthy and unhealthy versions of both.
Yeah.
But there is a balance in all of it.
Yeah, definitely.
And we've really been lied to by the stories that we're told.
And I think that, so if you take things literally, which a lot of people that I do, if they've spent their life learning about romance and intimate relationships through rom-coms, through stories that they're told.
80s teen movies really messed me up. They set me up with a lot of very poor expectations.
And, you know, throw it completely out there. I've got a lot of people that I hang out with that are learning about sex through porn, which is another whole thing. But if we are learning, if you take information literally and you go, okay, I'm going to watch this and I'm going to copy because this is the way that you do it, then you can, like beautiful Ronan on the show, for him it was like, when I get a girlfriend, the world will be great. And I've got to tell you, Osha, it's something that I'm actually trying to fight a lot because I've also got many people that I work with that think that if they have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, say one of my clients says to me, I really, really want, let's pretend it's a heterosexual woman. So she might say to me, I really want a boyfriend. I can't tell you how many times if I say why, The answer is because then I will be normal and people will know that I'm lovable. Because if you have a partner, then that says to the rest of the world, I am worthy, I am lovable, because somebody is attracted to you. So many people that I hang out with, it just does my head in, to tell you the truth, because I have to spend a lot of time with people before they talk about getting out in a dating scene or meeting somebody. I have to spend so much time just helping somebody, supporting somebody to look at themselves and go, you are bloody fabulous and you are incredible. And many people, as you know, prior to having they may get a diagnosis which helps give them an understanding of self. But for many, many years before that, they may have been isolated and ostracized and feeling they don't understand their own emotions, or they feel uncomfortable in their own skin, or they're overwhelmed. All of that impacts on somebody's identity. And so what we always talk about, that if you're going to go out on a date for the first time, you're basically selling yourself a little bit. You're basically going out, here I am, this wonderful human. If you've had a lifetime of feeling lesser than, then how do you do that? And if the idea is that as soon as somebody loves me, as soon as somebody will be with me, then I am worthy and I am lovable, it's a very, very vulnerable position that many people are in, because then they will go into relationships that are not healthy.
Yeah.
And not safe and not filled with respect.
I don't think that neurodiverse people are atypical in that, because there's no one listening or nobody watching that hasn't, it's like four really dangerous words.
Yeah.
When I get that job, then I will be. Yeah. When I get that guitar, then I will be. When I get that new pair of shoes, then I will be. When I move, then I will be. When I finally get this many likes,
I will be happy.
When I give someone else the remote control switch to my happiness, then no.
No.
You got to hold on to it.
Yeah.
It's hard.
It's really hard. And we also, all of us, it doesn't matter what your neurology, what your culture, what your gender, every single one of us, we dog ourselves. We have these negative thoughts about ourselves all the time. And so we also have to understand that is a part of being human, that we are our own worst enemy. And so battling against that as well. And if you're presented with that, you know how we sold that image of who the perfect person is and what they look like and what their career is.
Mate, it's the poster of the Princess Bride.
Exactly right. But the further you are in your own mind,
Carrie Ells and Robin Wright Penn, like there it is.
There it is.
And it's not.
It's not.
Never.
It's definitely not.
For the other person, you mentioned that, for example, you might have come to a realization, maybe a diagnosis, or, you found yourself a new situation, you've gone, right, this is it. Yeah. I'm now going to take responsibility for this. I'm going to do work on this. I'm going to find better outcomes for myself. And you start going, it's extraordinarily hard to shed the programming that has come.
Yep.
React like so deep, it's impossible sometimes to interrupt, and it might be there forever.
Mm-hmm.
What can you say to the other person? What can you say to the person who's engaging with them? I promise I'm not trying to get free advice out of you.
You mean the partner?
Yeah, to the partner of the person you're speaking about. What was I talking about? Men don't talk face to face, men talk shoulder to shoulder, right? Yeah, so that concrete slab out the back.
Yeah.
All right.
I love that. And do you know what?
It's true.
Nearly every single person I hang out with, I mean, you're pretty good, but many people can't do this
face to face.
So I sit side to side.
Took me a while.
Yeah. I do lots of drawings as well, because people always say to me, what are you drawing for, Jody? People don't realise that I'm doing that for two reasons. One, I'm trying to visually support auditory processing for somebody. That's number one. And I'm a shit drawer, but I do it because I'm supporting a secondary learning style or a preferred learning style. But do you know the most important part? It allows an autistic person to focus on something like the slab, like the side to side. It allows an autistic person to focus on something and not feel pressure from me that I'm going to look them in the eye and expect neurotypical connection.
Yeah.
Just throw it out the window and do it. Yeah.
So I'm out the back. I'm talking with these two. I was one of them close mate. And we were talking about ADHD.
Yeah.
And the guy who had showed up with my friend, he's the concrete guy, he's like, they're masters of artwork. They're incredible. And we talk about this, that, the other, and he goes, fuck, you and every tradie in Sydney. I was like, yeah, I guess, you know, there's why people don't do desk jobs. We were talking about that 20,000 number, the number that's kind of thrown around a bit, that by the age of 10, a kid with ADHD has heard 20,000 more negative messages from people that they love and trust than a neurotypical kid.
Yep.
And it obviously continues, but I was thinking about it, and that it explained a lot for people who love and trust me. If I'm being spoken to, it's because I've done something wrong.
Yep.
And that is the pre-filter
for
anything
that
people say to me sometimes, people who love me say to me. So what would you say to the other person in that situation about, hey, here's this person that you think is ace.
Mm-hmm.
Here's something you need to know about what it is to speak to them.
Yep.
They might, like, how do you talk to them about the first reaction you might get out of a conversation that you're having?
You talked about it, you know, all of the narrative that is built up in somebody's life that has to be shed. That narrative has to be broken down for anybody's partner as well. So particularly when we're talking about if that partner's neurotypical and a partner's been given diagnosis or helping somebody understand somebody's mental health or the way they communicate or their sensory, well, all of it. So it's about education to start with, helping somebody really understand what that person is experiencing. And I will do that through trying to do, you know how you know, kind of do that example. So if you just gave a classic example then, Osher, of saying that I will talk to people about many, many children with ADHD, many autistic kids. This is research. Do you know the words, the most words that come out of people's parents, people that love, or teachers or anybody in a child's life? No, don't, stop, and wait. They're the four words that come out more than anything else.
The four horsemen.
The four horsemen.
The ADHD apocalypse. Exactly. No, don't stop.
Exactly. I should get on to Gottman, who's a relationship specialist, and say, hey, I've got another four I want to talk
about.
The
other four horsemen.
But it's really supporting a partner to really understand where the other person is coming from, what their experience of life is. And I think the best way to do that all the time is say, okay, so if you take it away from the partner, say, if that was your child and this is how you heard another person speak to them, or if you were out in the street and you heard an adult speaking to a young person like this, what would your reaction be? So why do we speak to our partner like that? Or when thinking about the fact that I always talk about that we get more interaction with people, and many autistic people I know do this, they say that when they're okay, when they're being good, when they're just quiet, being by themselves as children, they were left alone. And that's kind of a reward in itself for some people.
Yeah.
But when they were really desperate for interaction, when they get it is when they play it up, because they may not have known how to initiate a reaction in interaction with somebody, or they needed to get somebody's attention. And so they went, oh, well, I know that if I'm do this, that's going to turn somebody towards me. Well, if that's what you've learnt your whole life, then you can do that with a partner. So it's helped. Yeah. Every single relationship, every single one has two stories in it. Always has two stories. It's never one story. And so we can't have an expectation. So it has to be, if we're talking about a couple where one person's neurodivergent, one person's neurotypical, they both have a story. They both have to learn about one another. They both have to learn to accommodate. They both have to learn to communicate. It's got to be reciprocal, as they say.
Yeah.
But relationships are never 50-50. It's very rare for people to go, oh, no, we do it all 50. Nah. There's some days that you're going to have to give way more support to Audrey, and there's days that she's going to have to give way more support to you. There's days that one of you is going to have to be more patient. There's going to be days that you're going to hit this wall and you're going to have to learn to communicate. And I'm not just talking about you. I'm talking about every person.
I brought it up so you can have something to, you know, a place bounce to support you. that's really I'm grateful that you were able to speak about that, because I think that's a thing that people might not get, or, you know, it's real for any relationship. Doesn't matter your history.
Yeah.
There's some element of that for any relationship. Yeah. But, you know, everyone's got an ex.
Yeah.
Just a moment away from Jody to say that if this episode's bringing you value, please do share the episode. Hit the little three dots or the burger or the arrow or whatever it is in the corner of your list, or share the URL in a post or an email. I don't care. Please share the episode. You can find out other episodes and other action there at oshaginsburg.com. If you look in the show notes, all the links are there for the mailing list and things. Please do rate and review the show. I am really, really grateful for anyone that takes the time to rate and review the show. We do need more ratings and reviews. It really, really helps us, and it costs you nothing except the tiny little bit of time it takes to write something. So to encourage you perhaps to leave a review, let me read a review from internet handle names. The review just says, a podcast that makes me feel good. I love the spirit, honesty, and calmness that Osha brings to the podcast on the days that I'm not doing so great. I find a few episodes, I listen, I feel better afterwards. Thanks for keeping it real and caring. Mate, Ella Maybe, thank you so much for leaving a review. That's exactly why I want to make the show. That's exactly why we all want to make the show. And thanks for reviewing the episode. Thanks for reviewing the show. And if you'd like to leave a review yourself, you can do it in the app you're listening to right now. We are back in a jiffy with Jody Rogers.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's a lot of celebration in the last couple of years, and a lot of visual, like, how shall I put this? Atypical sexualities have been very visual in the last number of years.
Yep.
And I always find it interesting that atypical sexualities are fine, yet there is still this kind of unspoken taboo around it. And I'll get to the neurodivergent stuff in a second, but I think it's truly fascinating that he's, you know, 20. He's a, you know, full-blooded 20-year-old young man, and he's having a wank to something and he's looking at his phone. Rock off your pop, son.
Yeah.
But the 20-year-old Nepalese Uber Eats driver having a wank to something on his phone, people are grossed out by this idea. And I find that kind of interesting that all that, you know, male sexuality particularly, female sexuality is allowed to be racially diverse.
Mm-hmm.
Male sexuality, it's white or it's weird and frightening and dangerous. Mm. Mm. And that's a pretty dangerous place for us to all be.
Yep.
But B, really shit because, you know, young guys who are here studying, they need a cuddle just as much as anybody.
Yep.
And there's nothing, as Professor G would say, I do love him, there's nothing more dangerous in this world than a lonely man with too much time on his hands. It's true, you know. So when it comes to developing sexualities and, you know, we talk about almost like the demonizing of atypical neurotypical people, sexualities. Mm-hmm. Early on, it might be too early for a diagnosis, or we might get a bit of a diagnosis, but there's a point in a kid's life when, you know, talk about young men, stiffies just start to happen. You start getting erections, all right? Audrey and I are very, very clear. I don't use the word stiffy, that was a word my mum used. It's an erection. Yep. It's a penis.
Yep.
It's not your dinky or your, you know. When we're dealing with neurotypical kids, how can we, I guess, what are some things that we can do around those kind of emergent properties of what it is to be a human in a way that won't set them up for internalized shame or things that might cause problems down the track?
See, I think about it as, well, number one, do you know they've now, you know how they can do those amazing photos in utero?
Oh,
you know
yeah,
they've
yeah,
actually
yeah.
got photos of males in utero holding onto their penis in utero, Osha. We're talking it starting before.
It's like you're telling me that, you know, like while I didn't see this,
yeah,
I believe it's always been true. Like, of course we're holding that.
And do you know, we all do things to self-soothe. So, you know, some of us play with our hair, some of us stroke our beards, some of us, you know, people, you walk into any kindergarten class and when kids are focused on something, so say they're listening to a story, oh, I swear to you, if you look around the room, you'll have somebody sucking the end of their hair, somebody biting a button on their shirt, somebody will have their finger up their nose, and I'm telling you, there will be people with their hands down their pants and they'll be playing with themselves. So we've got to start also thinking about the penis is just a part of the body and it's used for self-soothing because it feels good, just like every other part of self-soothing that we do. So when it's a little person, we just need to, all we have to teach a little person in early ages of their life is you just let it go. If you're in the family home, you don't even talk about it. It's when you do, you might see it in public, you might just say, you know, oh, Bobby, we just do that at home or we just do that in our bedroom or we just, you know, that's a private part of your body. And private part of your body, we're just saying that's a private part of your body to start with, to just go, that's for a private place.
Yeah.
But you do not, I've got to tell you, it's not sexual. Just because somebody's got an erection, little boys have been getting, babies get erections. It's part of the makeup, the anatomy of the and function of the human body. What the hell are we on about? It only becomes a sexualized thing when it's related to sexual thought. So, and you know, for some, if we're talking boys particularly, that might be 8, 9, 13. When there's actually the thought goes off in the head and they go, oh, and then the anatomy goes along with it, then it's a sexual thing. But it's along the line. If you just really clearly go link those two things going, private part of the body for a private place, that means when a boy starts really having a wank, then you're saying, buddy, just, you know, go and have a good time, but have a good time in private because we all have a good time, every single one of us, but we all don't announce it to everybody else. Yeah. You just don't, you just keep it as mellow and relaxed. I always laugh, Osha, because I've got a daughter and because there's been growing up in a house with a sexologist as a parent has been interesting for her, but I remember very clearly one day her having some mates home and she might have been 11 or something. And because everything that I do is visually supported with the people that I work with, I can remember one day coming out and she was saying to me, Mom, don't leave the word clitoris lying around the house. You know, because I had everything, you know, all the words of all the parts of the anatomy. Of
for
the
pin the tail on the
basically. So that's her life. You just have to keep things... You know, I always say, I wish that when we taught kids head, shoulders, knees and toes that we added in some other parts of the body too and just made it as normalised as that.
Heads and shoulders, knees and toes. Penis, balls.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, why not? Plastic,
Just watch where you clap your hands at the end. You know, make sure your hands are clear, young man. But you mentioned earlier, as we, you know, we're talking about emergent sexuality and bodies changing. You mentioned porn before.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard enough, no pun intended. It's hard enough trying to teach a kid about sex when they're, you know, as they say, 8 is too late. The chances that they have seen hardcore porn on a phone, it doesn't care if they don't have the phone. It's the kid at the bus stop next to them goes, oh, check this out.
Yeah.
By the time they're 8, that's the average age. And if you don't, like, that's the facts.
Yep.
It's an uncomfortable truth.
Yep.
But it is the truth.
Yeah.
All right. It's hard enough talking to kids about 8, 9, 10 about this kind of stuff. How do you have that conversation with someone who, you know, maybe can't read faces too well? Tones of voice don't really make a difference. It's very like this plus this equals this. Therefore, I should have this and not be able to see nuance or something like that. How do you even begin those conversations?
It's really difficult because, you know, everybody's an individual too, so it depends on when they've seen it. So if you're talking to somebody at that age, 8, that's often, it can be traumatizing.
Yeah, yeah.
If they haven't even got to the point where, you know, at school, we're still talking about where babies come from. You might get your puberty. That's still happening in year 6. We're not in front of it
Man, no.
in these ways.
Too late.
High school, even if they're getting sex education in high school, it's, can you imagine the complexity of many teachers? You know, one minute they're teaching mathematics, the next minute they're teaching pornography. And so we still say, oh, nobody's meant to be talking about porn, you know, until somebody's 18. You're not meant to be watching it until you're 18. But so it's,
I saw it at 11.
Exactly.
Well, in that's a magazine.
That's the age that we know is happening. It's very, very difficult because we have to help people critically analyze. So that's why it's important that we keep these conversations open and able to have the discussion. So same thing, many, many people that I work with, they can either have a porn addiction because porn has become their hyper-focus,
mm-hmm.
And they get a lot of pressure from it, and then they can routine it into their day, and so that can cause a lot of complexity because they can't move on to the next thing until that has happened, until they've had a wank and watched this. Some people will go down a line where they might be referred to me and somebody say, oh, they've got a paraphilia or a fetish, but in actual fact what it is, they've become focused on a special interest, and they might send me 1 month with a special interest in one thing, and then the next month they come back and it's something different because they've just snap gone onto something, but they're hyper-focused on learning about that, so they talk about it incessantly, and other people might think that it's become part of their sexuality. Teaching also about what an expectation of somebody else, as we keep talking about, to say, what do you think that makes that other person feel? We've got to be able to talk about porn really openly and go, actually, there's a formula to porn. Do you know there's a formula? You know, I'll do things like talking about, where do you reckon the camera angle comes in? Do you know about the industry?
Why do you never see the man's head?
Yeah, exactly.
Because it is built for you to imagine yourself in that place, and if you see another man's face, it's no longer good.
Yeah, and it's kind of talking about the difference between, almost like we talked about the rom-coms as well, what is the reality and helping people understand that it's an industry that we're being sold. So what are they trying to sell to us? So it's kind of putting it onto that. I often play with that way as well, especially with many people I work with that are really, they've got a lot of social justice and they're really into, you know, everything being correct and right. And I'll go, but what do you think about the porn industry? It's massive and the amount of money that they make from it. And then they kind of go, oh, shit, they're selling it. Because, you know, the number one search term in Australia, or this is from research done with 16 to sort of 20-odd-year-olds, is teen. So it's also kind of talking about who's actually, I mean, everybody, of course, is accessing, not everybody, that's an exaggeration, generalisation, but a majority, large majority of people, of course, have been exposed to porn, of course, have watched porn and they seek it out, whatever shape or form they want to look at it. But there's a high statistic that that's something that's being searched. So the porn industry also knows, they watch our algorithms. They watch what we're looking for, and then that is created, the market's created in that way. It's about keeping the conversation open. If we're still living in a society where we can't talk about these things, it makes it, one, it makes it hard for any child. For people that I hang out with on a day-to-day basis, once again, breaking sex and sexuality down into very concrete, blunt, explicit terminology, pulling it to pieces so we can critically analyse it so that person can make an informed choice, because there's a lot of people that aren't making informed choices. They're just being taken along for the ride.
There's a person who I'm really, really close to. We worked together for a long time, and they got, you know, met someone wonderful. He was fantastic, and they had a kid, and then I just didn't hear from them for like 3 years. And turns out that the son, like, she wanted to be a mother more than anything. And this kid, there's a lot going on. This kid's neurodivergent. This kid's like full chaos. There's biting, there's violence. She didn't know what to do with it. Kid's supposed to be cuddly, toddlers. Like, how? And I didn't know what to do. I didn't hear from her. She didn't answer my text. How can we support people like that?
Listen. Don't tell them how to parent. Don't tell them what to do. Listen. And the best thing we can do is just nod our heads. If you understand that nodding your head means I'm listening, I'm there with you, if that's what they need. Because the individual struggle of parents. We all struggle as parents because you want to get it perfect and you never ever can. But when you're a parent that is watching your child, and I believe when he was a little tucker, he really struggled with the world. He was having a lot of sensory problems, so he would have been overwhelmed. He would have been melting down. I think he had communication. You know, he didn't have what we call functional communication, speaking communication to say what he needed or how he needed his needs met or what he was experiencing. Or, you know, imagine if a piece of shirt, you know, a tag on your shirt was actually incessantly hurting you, agonising, you know, cutting you, and you don't have the capacity to say, I need this shirt off. So you just rip your clothes off, and when somebody else is trying to put your clothes back on, of course you're going to bite them because that's torture. You're going to bite the torture. You're going to fight against it.
Yeah.
When, if anybody is going through that, we need to support them. It's like all we can, the best we can do is be, I always say it's like being a strut washer. There's times in life you don't have to come in and fix the building. You come in and you just put the strut in and you just hold it up and you give it the support it's needed until it can stand on its own. And if any person is saying to you that they are parenting a young child, a young autistic child, that means that that young autistic child is learning to move through a very complex world, and what we should be doing is putting as many struts around those parents as we possibly can. And it's no wonder she went missing for 3 years because she was only probably just had her head above water.
Yeah. But what's incredible now is this kid, now 17, 18, got a job, plays in a footy team, amazing. And it is unbelievable what the right support, open communication, acceptance, and like he's 6'6", he's a humongous child.
Yeah.
He's a gigantic kid.
Yeah.
And he waits tables.
Yeah.
He waits fucking tables. Yeah. He looks strangers in the eye and says, what can I get you?
Yeah.
You know, that's hard for me to do.
Yeah.
And like that just, I'm full of goosebumps because it's just an extraordinary outcome.
Yeah.
But it goes to show how much the right amount of props around a family can do for the outcomes of everybody.
Yes.
I could talk to you for hours about this shit, but because I find it just so fantastic. But let me ask you, to watching the people, like the most, thank you for writing the book because for people who want to dig a bit deeper, there's a lot of, I think that's what we love about watching the show is there's a lot of lessons that we can learn about our own relationships because the way that the people in the show move through life, it's like Duplo Lego.
Yeah.
Right? It's the 12 pack of crayons. It's not the 16,000 colors. It's like, nope, it's this or it's not. That's it. It's on off. It's very, not the word binary, but it's very, you know, monochromatic in, and so we are able to assess our own situation against this. Yet to see the amount of love and just joy and devotion and presence. Oh my God. So present in the moment. It's aspirational. It is aspirational. What can neurotypical people learn about connecting with one another from people who find love and connection, who have a, you know, neurodivergent brain?
Mm. The whole book that I've written, Unique, is really, when I've given it to autistic people in my life, you know, they've basically said, I've written this in the book, they're, oh, I thought this was about autism. But this is about all of us.
Yeah,
it's about all of us. And I think that it is incredibly important that we are curious rather than judgmental, that rather than stepping in from our own perspective, we take a second to go, hang on, every single person in this world thinks differently, senses differently, feels differently, experiences emotion differently. Every single one, we're told as kids, or you would have been told too, remember in kindy, they said, oh, everybody's unique. That's the truth. And so if we only think about another person should be doing it the way, if I went through the world going, everybody should be doing it the way that Jody Rogers is doing it, that's not being part of humanity. That's not about connection. That's about me wanting everybody to be the same as me. We're not the same. We're all different. And if we just took a moment to frigging celebrate that and go, how cool is it How cool is it that 8 billion people are all experiencing a lifetime completely differently? Lots of similarities, but we're all doing it completely differently. That blows my mind. I love it.
The idea, and it's not my word, but it should or must. You must, like, to get caught up in masturbation. I've read about it.
Oh, I love that.
If you find yourself masturbating about someone or something, I can tell you from experience, if you are trying to organize the world to be the way you want it to be, it is never going to be satisfying.
It's always going to fail.
You are never, ever going to get to a point where it feels okay.
No.
Because it never, ever, ever is going to get there.
No.
Because everything is in motion. Everything changes all the time, yep. Always. You just got to be okay with, you know, take care of yourself, have good boundaries. And as my brother would always say, it's their garden, their path, man.
I like it. I like it.
You're ace. Thank you so much for this. I'm so grateful that you exist in the world.
Oh, thanks for having me, Osha.
That was Jodie Rogers. Her new book is called Unique, and you can get it where you buy your books. That's where books usually sell. Shops, I believe they're called. I love that chat. I really liked how she spoke about understanding and accepting just the different perspectives that people might have on their sexuality, and also kind of how that's really essential to have a healthy relationship, to respect the other person's perspective on how things might be. Also, I really liked the bit where she spoke about, you know, self-soothing behaviors in kids, including those related to sexuality, the research around that and shaming kids who... It's not a sexualized action at all, but because it looks like it, an adult may shame them for some sort of, you know, pumping or touching or whatever, and that the research just has shown how that can really mess somebody up. I really like that. I really like how she spoke about how it's important for us to understand and normalize those things. That was really, really good to hear. What a legend. What a great human being. The book's great. You'll dig it. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to the people that helped me make the show. On audio post was Andy Ma. Mikey Ward did the video. Abby Benno is our producer at large, hopefully producing another child for her family right now. While she's on mat leave, Ella Bramer-Jones is looking after the tools. Toe Hyder made all the music. Ben and Monica keeping the lights on at OGTV. And thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. You can find the mailing list in the show notes. You can email me there. Also, just drop me a message on Instagram if you want. Thanks for being a part of it. I'll see you Friday.